Had it right away.
Morning, everyone. The E12 Finance Division will come to order. Today's Thursday, March 20, 2014. We have five bills before us. First, we'll hear from Senator Saxhog, Senate File 2167. Welcome, Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you say, today we're presenting Senate File 2167. This bill modifies a previous appropriation for equity and telecommunications access with an increase of about $6 million. The need for this increase stems from a recent jump in broadband use in our schools. In fact, the Governor's Broadband Task Force recently recommended this appropriation be increased to meet the growing demand. With me today are Mark Johnson, Director of East Central Minnesota Education Cable Cooperative, and Dennis Fazio, Director of Technical Services for Technology and Information Education Services, known as TIES. To explain the bill in more detail and to answer any questions, maybe start out with Mr. Johnson.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us. Thank you for having us this morning. I'm Mark Johnson, the Executive Director of the East Central Minnesota Educational Cable Cooperative. We call it ECMEC because it's easier to say. We represent school districts. We're owned and operated by 14 member school districts, most of the schools in Chisago, Isani, Mille Lacs, Kennebec, and Pine counties, so just north of the metro area. We provide technology services and distance learning services to our member school districts. We're requesting this morning an increase of $6 million to Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid, which is a state program that helps school districts pay the cost of Internet access after they have tapped the federal E-rate telecommunications discount program. Currently, Minnesota school districts receive approximately $22 to $25 million from that federal E-rate program to sustain levels of broadband connectivity necessary to deliver educational opportunities to students and to also run their operations. The Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid program then makes up the difference for the portion that is not covered by the federal E-rate program. Currently, this program is funded at $3.75 million. When this funding is delivered to each region or school district by the Minnesota Department of Education, it is prorated. And currently, it is enough to fund about 43% of the difference between actual expenses and the portion reimbursed through the federal E-rate program. The reason this program is particularly important to school districts is because there are many other costs to maintaining technology infrastructure that are not covered by any programs. This program then, by helping to cover and equalize the cost of internet access, which is one of those costs that varies widely depending on your geographic location in the state, this frees resources for the school district to support local infrastructure with things such as networking equipment, wiring, wireless access points, computers, tablets, other technologies that are needed in today's classrooms. Schools use broadband connectivity these days for a wide variety of purposes. We deliver college career readiness opportunities to students using online, blended, and two-way interactive learning. In ECMEC alone, we offer some 35 interactive classes every day to over 600 students, including to places outside of our cooperative like Northwest Minnesota. These are classes that students otherwise wouldn't have access to, and many of them carry college-level credit. We have content providers in the state that provide interactive opportunities. We sometimes call them virtual field trips. We have providers in the state such as the Minnesota Zoo, Minnesota Historical Society, Great Lakes Aquarium, the International Wolf Center in Ely, and they're offering educational opportunities to students via two-way interactive video that they wouldn't otherwise have access to due to time constraints, transportation costs, etc. With the increased use of tablet devices, laptops, and other mobile technologies, and the availability of information through online means, the use of expensive and often outdated textbooks is now subject to critical examination in many districts. Many of them wish now to phase out the purchase of these physical textbooks in favor of digital resources, e-texts, and other content that is available online and delivered over the broadband networks that are supported by this program. Schools are also under increasing demand to conduct online testing for the state MCAs and other measures of student progress. There are strict bandwidth and infrastructure requirements placed on schools by the testing companies that schools must meet in order to provide students with the best testing environment. You have a handout in the packet that outlines many additional examples of why this funding is important to Minnesota students and their school districts. I'd like to kind of leave you with a brief story. In 2006, I took a position as Director of Technology for ISD 15 in St. Francis, a North Metro school district of about 6,000 students. At that time, they were what you would consider bandwidth poor. They didn't know of any providers who could provide them with the kind of broadband access they needed to provide all the educational opportunities that at that time were just becoming available through the internet. When I got there, went on a listening tour and talked to administrators, program directors, department chairs, and teachers, asking them what they wanted in instructional technology, what were their goals, what were their needs. All I heard during that time were stories about the things they couldn't do because they didn't have the adequate bandwidth. They talked about online resources that the district had purchased that students couldn't use because they didn't have the bandwidth to support it. They talked about days or periods of a day when they were told no internet access in the classrooms or the labs because of testing or because the finance department had to run payroll, and things like that. It was a sort of a depressing story to hear. What we did is we went out and got them involved in a cooperative like ECMEC and like TIES and some of the other regional cooperatives and found a provider that could provide them the access. In about 3 months, we got them connected, and all of the bandwidth caps and concerns were eliminated. A few months later, we went into a strategic planning process with that district, and I was amazed at the way the conversation had changed. And they were starting to talk about all the things they could do with technology because of this program. They got into a cooperative that was funded partially by this program. The conversation in the district completely changed, and it was it was remarkable. So just that was a quick story. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I'll turn it over now to my colleague from TIES, Dennis Fazio, who can address some other additional points about the program that are of great importance to all of our districts, but perhaps especially to the metro school districts.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Welcome, Mr. Fazio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Fazio. I said I'm the Director of Technical Services at TIES. This is a consortium organization based in the Twin Cities area. My responsibility there is to provide internet service to about four dozen districts around the metro area, among other things.
For our viewers, Mr. Fazio, could you share what TIES, what the acronym stands
Yes.
for?
TIES is Technology Information Educational Services, was established about 40 years ago to provide common data processing facilities to school districts on a more economical basis. It has, of course, grown into multiple other technologies to assist school districts with professional development and infrastructure technology. And as I was stating, one of my responsibilities is to get bandwidth to my districts of about four dozen. And that has been an increasing challenge, of course, as the districts have moved into portable devices and a whole new wave of technology and methods of curriculum have arisen. In your pack, you'll find a graph that I thought I'd bring along, because we talk in the abstract of increased bandwidth and the need, but it's always handy to have something in, well, green and white in front of you that actually shows the growth. Now, I've been in the internet business since 1991 in various roles, and in the 90s, it would double like this every year when it was first growing, and then it slowed down a little bit. It was growing, but not at this rate. I'm starting to see a whole new growth again, as you can see in the graph. This is a one-year progression of bandwidth usage of all the TIES 40 districts, and these are all in the metro area. It says 1 to 2 gigabits on the front, on the left side, but this is really a one-day average. The daily peaks are really in the 4 to 6 gigabit range, but this does represent, as you can see, usage through last spring, summer when the schools are closed, and the ramp-up that occurs in the fall and in the spring so far this year. And it is a doubling of bandwidth. And I've seen this for the past couple of years, and it's continuing to grow. The schools have a challenge, of course, of deploying infrastructure to accommodate this, not only now and in the future. The best way to do that is to construct fiber optic cable, and many of the districts have done that. And that's where the challenge comes in. An investment in fiber optic cable is really a decades-long investment, so the additional funding that would be available here to help them build this infrastructure, both in the rural areas where the distances are greater and therefore the costs are more expensive, to the urban areas where the distances are shorter but the cost is actually higher on a per-mile basis. It's about $25,000 a mile to build fiber in the rural areas and can be up to $300,000 a mile in downtown Minneapolis, for instance, usually about $70,000 to $75,000 in the suburbs. And as I said, this is an investment in the long term, so we urge you to assist because I can get 1 to 10 gigabits of bandwidth on a fiber optic cable, and I can then, if that's not enough, multiplex it to multiple channels of that. If you remember a while ago, I brought some visual aids, too. We had our information exchanged on floppy disks. This carries 1.5 megabits. At that time, the districts were using what were called T1 lines of 1.5 megabits per second to handle most of their needs. Now we use these. This is 8 gigabytes. A couple of Microsoft Word documents on here, an entire high-definition movie on here. And that's what the districts are doing. They're using high-definition movies for instruction to get streaming media off the Internet and collaborate with others visually. So that was kind of the key points I wanted to make. We're available for filling in additional information with if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fazio. Questions from the committee? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I notice this is about equity in telecommunications. So is the money targeted to those who really need it, or is it evenly spread? How is that being done?
Mr. Johnson.
Hi, Senator Bonhoff, Chair, rest of the committee. Thank you for the question. Yes, it is intended to equalize, and it does that through a couple of means. First of all, the E-rate program funding is applied before the telecommunications equity aid kicks in. And the E-rate program, of course, is based upon NSLP, National School Lunch Program, data. So districts that have a higher need get a higher amount of funding there, which then means they have a smaller difference left. But then this will kick in to cover a good portion, or at least 43% of that difference for them. So districts that are of greater need certainly are getting more aid between the two programs. They work in cooperation with each other. So.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address Senate File 2167? Senator Saxog, clearly there's a need. You've documented it well with your witnesses. And as we proceed to establish priorities, this will certainly be in mind. We'll entertain a motion, Senator Saxog, at this time.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that this bill be laid on the table and considered to be possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Saxog's motion. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carried. Thank you
very
much,
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Saxog,
members.
And to the witnesses.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senate File 1796, Senator Cohen. And members, as Senator Cohen approaches, I'll remind members that Senator Franzen has Senate File 1966, which we heard at our first meeting this session, and that addresses the Early Learning Scholarship Program, the removal of the cap, et cetera. This is also substantially embraced in this measure, but will, in the interest of time, not focus on that for the presentation with the consent of the author. Welcome, Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and appreciate that. And that's actually helpful because I have a funeral I have to get to after this this presentation. So I know you've heard from Senator Franzen, and the language Senator Franzen and I have relative to lifting of scholarship cap to and the extension of the scholarships, the amount is basically the same. So you've heard that issue. I wanted to present the other two parts of the bill, and members, if you'll look on the bill, there's Section 4, Learning Mentorship Pilot Program, and then a very small section, appropriation section, Section 6. So let me present both issues. I do have with me Bethany Kruger, who is the Associate Director of College Possible Twin Cities. And we talk about the achievement gap, Mr. Chairman and members. Obviously, we have focused on early education in this legislature, looking at the preschool population. We have in the proposed expansion that I presented last night to the Health and Human Services Committee, we discussed homicide visits, for instance. This is another facet, and this would provide mentorships at both, and there's going to be some, the language in front of you is not exactly what I thought we had drafted, so I'm going to ask the committee to just change a couple of pieces of language, but let me first present, Mr. Chairman, what the concept is, and that is to provide mentorships to students both at an elementary level, that's a new part of this, and then at a high school level. Because when we talk about the achievement gap and making sure that we have kids who are ready to go on to a higher level of achievement and learning, at times we forget the back end of it, where if we have children in difficult schools, children at a poverty level, there are all sorts of factors, as I think this legislature, irrespective of geography and partisanship, understand that when you have factors such as a more difficult home life, financial pressures, access to nutrition, it just makes it that much more difficult for a student at any level to be prepared to then go on to the next higher level. So what this language does is to allow state support to enhance the program. I would like to have Ms. Kruger speak relative to College Possible. There's been some significant press coverage of the program, and it's a very active program in a number of Twin City schools. I think something like Ms. Kruger can identify the number. I think somewhere 15 to 20 schools. But as successful as it's been, there has not been the ability to take it to a greater level, and in particular, to take it to non-metro schools, because obviously if we talk about some of the rural pockets in Minnesota, if we talk about the reservation schools, you have some of those same difficulties. And so my hope is to graft a legislative proposal onto what's been a very successful program. So with that intro, maybe I could ask Ms. Kruger to provide some testimony as to what the program has been doing, what her experience has been. And then I've talked briefly to counsel about some brief language changes.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. And Mr. Arneson is drafting, and we'll get a progress on that soon. Welcome, Ms. Kruger.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here to talk about College Possible. We are a nonprofit organization, started in the Twin Cities over 13 years ago, and our mission is to help low-income high school students both gain admission to college and to see them through college graduation. I've been with the organization for about 13 years, so almost since the very beginning, and we are currently here in the Twin Cities in 20 high schools where we're serving about 1,700 high school juniors and seniors, and we follow all of those students through college graduation, as I've said earlier. So we are supporting well over 3,000 students who are making their way through the college trenches right now. We've seen enormous success, which has allowed us to replicate our model, not only over and over here in the Twin Cities at different schools, but also nationally, where we are one of five sites across the country implementing College Possible curriculum. So we've seen fantastic results, as I have mentioned. Our students are persisting in graduating five times higher than that of their low-income peers who aren't involved in our program. We see tremendous results when you look at baseline ACT scores to final ACT scores to college admission rates in addition to enrollment and matriculation and persistence. So we really feel like there are more students to serve. Year after year, there's about 200 low-income high school students who have the potential to go on to college and don't. And we feel like we could be part of that solution. So, again, happy to be here and to answer any questions. And you've seen some literature in front of you about who we are, what we do. But, again, happy to answer more questions.
Thank you. I had one question. college, I think, of post-secondary opportunities. Does this preclude great vocational school opportunities as well, where there may be a semantics, but...
Absolutely not. Our goal for students is that they find the right fit. What we ask of them upon entrance into our program as a high school junior is that they think about all of their options. We think that students oftentimes are very focused on maybe something they've heard about or maybe something that they've been told. And at the end of the day, it is their decision, their family's decision. We at College Possible, because we are prepping for the ACT, we do ask that students have an interest in a four-year institution. But at the end of the day, not all of our students do end up at a four-year school.
Okay, thank you. Further questions of Ms. Kruger? Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kruger, thanks for being here today. I shared with Senator Sumpf that I think you do it the very best of anyone. And the federal program is often talked about, TRIO, and they do some similar things, but I just really appreciate your reach down into the high school and then you're sticking with those students and making, and the outcome is really completion, and that's what we all focus on. And so I am so grateful to Senator Cohn for doing this, and look forward to helping in any way I can.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohn or whoever, how does a school get to be a partner school?
Sure. I can take that. When we first started 13 years ago, it was a lot of door knocking to say, let us prove ourselves. And now here in the Twin Cities, we've established the success of the program that as funding comes along, as we're ready to grow, we submit an RFP and we ask schools to apply if there is interest and a need at the institution or at their institution. So what we found is currently we've got 20 high schools on a waiting list, waiting for our services, have students to serve. We just aren't ready to grow because of that funding piece.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kruger. Please proceed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you've had a description of the College Possible program. As I said, the legislation attempts to graft both. It was drafted where I just realized with one section that had not, or a couple of words that had not been included. I'm not sure what got lost in translation. And I think, unfortunately, with apologies to the committee, that's what I get for being chairman of the Finance Committee. I just work with all these numbers, and I've forgotten how to read English.
We understand.
Yeah, thank you. So maybe there's a program for
everything
finance
we do
chairman.
Goes under your scrutiny. You're good.
So, Mr. Chairman, I've talked to counsel about language to incorporate some other things. I don't know if he's ready with that to present that to the committee, and if members would be approving, maybe somebody. Senator Bonhoff said she wanted to be of help, so maybe somebody could offer the amendment. But
Mr. Arneson,
Mr. Chair, and members, I do have a language and could describe it orally. I do know that it's coming off the printer downstairs, too, in case
let's wait.
The committee's wish to wait for something on paper.
We'll wait, and Senator Bonhoff will offer that when ready.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, if it was going to be prepared, certainly let's wait. I can present the other part of the bill while we're waiting, if that's possible. So, Mr. Chairman, in this case, I'm both the senator and I'm the witness. And I love to offer context. Members know that. About me, so if you'll allow me a couple minutes, because I think the only person who knows this is Senator Bonhoff. But I've been involved with a program that I've been just struck by, and I'm asking for an appropriation, and I should make it clear there are a couple of caveats to this, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm expecting we might have a small legacy funding bill, small. It depends on where we go with the tax bill. If that's the case, now there will be the larger, Senator Saxhaug knows, there's the larger Lessard-Sams bill because they budget on a yearly basis. The other legacy areas have budgeted on a biannual basis. But with the increased revenues, the surplus monies, we potentially have the ability to do a small legacy bill for the other articles of the legacy amendment. If that's the case, this appropriation probably could come through that to the State Arts Board as opposed to asking for a direct appropriation. So that's the predicate. What this involves is a program that has been just absolutely striking, and that's the Turnaround Arts Program. So this is the context I have to offer. In the summer of 2009, President Obama nominated me to serve on what's called the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. It's a committee that's advisory to the White House that was established during the first year of President Reagan's term. It was also determined at that time, that first year in 1981, that the First Lady, Mrs. Reagan, would serve as the honorary chair of the committee. That's continued to the present date, so that the honorary chair now is Mrs. Obama. The committee is approximately 35 of us from around the country. To be fair, it's very heavy, New York, Washington, L.A., and I want members to know I've yelled about geographic diversity at committee meetings. Then I'll get the message. And the committee has worked on a number of programs, the principal one of which is called Turnaround Arts. And it's a program that selected, it sent out an RFP, in effect, to all of the school improvement grant schools, as determined by the Department of Education, the federal department, you know, the bottom 5% schools in the country, irrespective of where they were, what they were, asking for an interest in participation. From that, the committee got approximately, I think there were maybe 50 applications or so. And committee staff, Rachel Goslin is the name of our executive director, lowered the schools to, I think, about 20. The staff conducted site visits and then selected 7 original schools. These are very difficult schools, and integrated an arts education program with the rest of the school curriculum. What has happened as a consequence is significant success. In the year and a half of the program, the schools involved, which are very, very tough schools, and there are schools, there are urban schools, there's a reservation school in Montana, which has had some particular difficulty, school in Des Moines, school in New Orleans, school in Portland, school in Denver, Boston, Hartford, D.C. And the results, the metrics, which have been studied by Booz Allen and the University of Chicago, have been striking in terms of a significant increase in achievement scores, math and science and reading, a significant decrease in disciplinary problems within the schools, and a very significant increase in attendance in the schools. Coupled with that, on a more anecdotal basis, we've had a chance to meet with, I think, 3 of the principals, there's been a huge increase in parental involvement. On an anecdotal basis, the committee's had a chance to go to the Savoy School in the Anacostia neighborhood of Washington, D.C., on 2 occasions, and we've seen both in November of 2012 and November of 2013 what's happened and the striking difference from the start of the program, November of 2012 to 2013. During our first visit, Rachel, on our way to the on the van we were on, said that at that school, half the fathers at the school were either in jail or prison. You know, this is a tough, tough school, and the results have been striking. The reason to bring the issue here is that Minnesota is a finalist for the next, for phase 2. We won't know probably for a few weeks as to whether or not Minnesota will be selected. And I was hoping Pam Paulson from the Purpose School would be here. Unfortunately, she has, there's some a day-long event or something with the Purpose School, unfortunately. So we couldn't get her here because she's been the person who's put this all together. But it's a joint effort between the Purpose School and the State Arts Board for its for Minnesota's participation. And what would be involved with Minnesota, and I'm hoping one of the appeals to to the staff, as a, I should just mention, as a committee, the President's Committee, we're not like this committee or legislative committees. We're more of a board of directors, so we don't participate in, you know, these decisions. What I'm hoping is that Minnesota, because of the diversity we represent with the Minnesota application, will be selected, because the intent is to, or the proposal has 4 schools, 4 districts, 2 urban, Minneapolis and St. Paul, rural, and a reservation school. So it's not simply an urban, the Minnesota application is not simply an urban application, and I think that's going to be distinguished from probably most of the other applications in phase 2. The other thing that's been striking about this is obviously because it has the imprimatur of the White House, there's been some national corporate support, and kind of a sidebar, the President and the First Lady wanted to involve actual artists in this committee for the first time. So there are about 35 of us, but there are, I think, 8 or 9 artists. Yo-Yo Ma, Sarah Jessica Parker, Forrest Whitaker, I think Kerry Washington, Ed Norton, Chuck Close, a couple of others. And so these folks have all adopted a school. So there's going to be an artist that will go to each of the selected Phase 2 schools. And I don't know if the committee wants to take a vote on which artist you'd prefer to have come in Minnesota. But although I tell you, it's an interesting committee, and being with some of these folks, it's I can't say it's a cut above my finance committee, but it's at least nobody comes in with quite the flash of Sarah Jessica Parker in my committee, at least up to the present date. But the Turon Arts Program has been just a striking program, and I don't presume to be a professional educator, but on an anecdotal basis, watching the what took place at the Savoy School in one of the toughest neighborhoods you could imagine in the city of Washington, D.C., was just striking. And we had a chance to talk at some length with the principal of that school, as well as the regular teachers who've talked about how the program and the principal at Savoy made it very, very clear. There was zero parental involvement prior to this program. The families were just in such difficult shape that even those who wanted to participate simply couldn't. But the program has been such that it's brought in parental involvement. The principal from Des Moines also made this, the same thing very clear when she spoke to us in November, that the parental involvement, the family involvement, has gone from very, very low to almost 80-90%, and that the integration of what the children are doing in school with the parental involvement has been striking. But that's most evident with the metrics that have followed these several schools with very significant increases. So that's the context of the very simple appropriation request. I had hoped that there would be some decision coming from committee staff prior to this point. I think we're on the verge of it, but that's where the appropriation is being requested. And again, Mr. Chairman, members, if we have a small legacy bill, it would be my intent to have that presented in that fashion.
Well, Senator Cohen, thank you for articulating the need, the firsthand account, and it's very convincing. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 1796?
Anybody from the department?
Yes, from the department as well. Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Cohen, we are awaiting the amendment, but in the event it is going to cause you to be here too long, recognizing you have a wake, a funeral, we will have it processed and we can modify it, and it's here. So we're going to have it distributed, and Senator Bonoff moves the amendment, which is going to be described. We're going to expedite this a bit, recognizing a schedule emergency. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to offer, but I also do have an additional amendment that would just put the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation Scholarship Program pilot sites that the MELF programs would be eligible. Oh. So I was just going to give that to before Senator Cohen leaves to make sure it was on the record.
Okay. We do have the A3, which Senator Bonoff will offer. And this would embrace the author's intent for College Possible for getting at the program involvement that was discussed. Mr. Arneson, would you like to articulate further?
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding from the author's intent is to not draft this bill so narrowly that it would exclude programs offered to middle and high schoolers, for example. And so to that end, the A3 amendment removes references to elementary kindergarten through grade three, early, et cetera, and also makes clear at line 3.9 after the period that the commissioner, when the commissioner is selecting pilot sites, could select existing complementary programs as pilot sites for this mentorship pilot program.
Senator Cohen?
Yep, and Mr. Chairman, that's what I had asked counsel to draft.
Okay. Discussion on Senator Bonhoff's A3. Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Carried. Senator Bonhoff, you have an oral amendment, which you shared. That's not in writing yet.
Do I have it?
That'll be distributed. It is the...
Mr. Chair, since we weren't talking about the early childhood scholarships, I thought you didn't actually want me to offer it, but just to mention it. So it's up to you.
No, you may offer it. It's embraced in the subject of the bill.
Okay, great. This is the A2.
Okay, the A2 will be distributed, and you may speak to it again briefly, Senator Bonner.
Thank you. Senator Franzen presented the early childhood scholarships, and they're also within this bill, although we're not talking about them. There were four original MELF pilot sites that really provided the foundation for all of the early learning scholarships to happen, and those pilot sites invested a great deal in making sure parent aware was all throughout their area and bringing in the daycare community and really getting a broad community support and structure in place to support these scholarships. And the way that the department did the formula, the one of the pilots was actually left out. The why is that a early learning pilot. And so this says, notwithstanding paragraph A, all Minnesota Early Learning Foundation Scholarship Program pilot sites are eligible to accept an early learning scholarship under this section, and I have spoken to the department about that.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bob. Senator Cohen.
The amendment's fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ms. Hulu.
Nothing to add.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on the A2? Further discussion? Not all in favor? Indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Any further discussion on Senate File 1796 as amended? Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, I would like to request 1796 in my committee. There's a significant policy that has not been heard in committee about the pilot site selection, the student selection, the mentor criteria, the elementary mentor definition, and the report. And so I would like to make a request that this bill moves to policy committee from here.
Okay. Well, you're the chair of the finance. Anything that from our committee needs obviously to go to Senator Cohen. So guidance.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Torres-Ray, if you recall, this bill was actually scheduled in your committee, and I haven't had a chance to talk to you directly. There was some confusion between our committees and committee administrators relative to scheduling of some of the bills and some of the in the flurry of bills, what ended up in your committee, what ended up in the finance committee. So you actually have a duplicate bill, a partial duplicate bill in your committee right now. But if we're going to have a turnaround on the floor, obviously we'd have to report the bill out of finance. This bill was referred to Senator Wieger's division, and we'd have to vote the bill out of the full finance committee, and then have it re-referred to the Education Committee, make that referral from Finance. So I'm not sure where we are in terms of scheduling, but, again, you have some of the language in your committee right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is correct, Senator Cohen. I do have it, and it was my understanding that you were still working on it, so we were waiting for you to ask for rescheduling in my committee. So I have not heard back, and I would like to have a discussion in my committee about this policy.
All right, well, Mr. Chairman, rather than you have other bills on your agenda, rather than take up any more of your time. Let me talk to Senator Torres Ray on the floor this, when we go into session. And we don't have a finance committee meeting set up this morning anyways. Hope the committee might consider, you know, your division might consider this bill relative to what kind of an omnibus bill you put together. And obviously we have the language in the finance committee, and I can talk to Senator Torres Ray about working out something with her committee so the committee has the opportunity to hear the language.
Thank you, Senator Cohen.
I'd agree with that. Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 1796 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the division's omnibus bill. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator
Chairman
Cohen and Ms. Krueger.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senate File 1721, Senator Hoffman, school readiness. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have two bills here, and I got the wrong packet, so I got the right one.
It's your choice if you'd like to go to the first packet.
Mr. Chair, I do. There's a members, thank you for hearing Senate File 1721 on school readiness. There's a brief technical amendment, A1, perhaps.
Senator Hoffman offers the A1 technical amendment. This is the first stop. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me at the table is Steve Kerr, who's the Director of Community Education and Government Relations with Anoka Hennepin Schools, and also Superintendent Dave Webb from South St. Paul Schools. Chairs and members, school readiness is a primary funding stream for school-based preschool programs. As you know, state dollars are targeted at preschool populations, more at the risk of starting kindergarten behind their peers. I just want to point something out. Last night in Health and Human Services, Senator Benson had remarked about what the benchmarks in kindergarten were, and I hope Steve Kerr will enlighten us on what our district had to do regarding the successes of preschool and actually moving the kindergarten target, which was pretty remarkable indeed. Eligible children are ages 3 through 5 years old, with the bulk of children being 4 years old. The state appropriation was set at $10 million in 1991 and has remained unchanged since the program's inception. I think it's important that we start to change this pattern. Mr. Chair and members, I want to turn it over to Mr. Kerr and also Superintendent Webb.
Welcome.
Chair Wieger, committee members. First, Chair Wieger, thank you for visiting Anoka Hennepin and seeing some of the work we're doing to close the achievement gap and some of the success we're having for students and some of your committee members joining us. For Senator Johnson, thank you for some of your support and guidance as we work through this issue, and appreciate that help and your visit to us and some of the advice you have given me. I think I'm going to focus, it's always important to kind of have a punchline, but I'm going to start probably with the punchline. And I'd ask members, you should have this handout if you do. I believe if not, that's going to be kind of an anchor point, so if you can dig that out.
You can see it.
No.
So members, do you have it? I think we're looking for it right now. So
it's being distributed. I'll move on.
I think what
a Vanna here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Hoffman and I have worked together for a few years as a school board, and so he and I have a relationship away from the table. I will ask members to focus on the inside-facing page, which is kind of the sort of the, so that my words have more meaning to you. This is some of what we've had for success for the students. So the graph on the one side, this is our results from 12-13 with our children. You'll see a fall assessment and you'll see a spring assessment. You'll notice that there is a rather drastic change in what's happening with those children. So, A, we're successful. B, let me tell you that some of those things don't happen accidentally. It's a lot of the adults in the organization and the parents focused on the specific objective of closing the achievement gap and moving this needle along and playing nice with each other. We have done a great deal of work in Anoka Hennepin to align our curriculum, our instruction, our staff development, our leadership to achieve these results. We've engaged our families and our parents in that process. so that this graph doesn't just stand alone, let me give you a couple of stories. We are now getting to enough of a critical mass that we're impacting with our results in Anoka-Hennepin that it's important for us, and we have been working over the last year and a half, to re-engineer kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. Because if you're bringing in these kids at this much higher level, if you don't want that trajectory to fall, you've got to do something different through the rest of the system. And we have been doing that. And you can see some of these kinds of things happening, and you can see some large jumps occurring in our kindergarten results because of some of these kids coming through. The district this year had to change their entry benchmarks for, because we screen all the kids when they come in. The benchmarks we saw with the kids is the district had to raise the benchmarks because the kids are all coming in higher. So we couldn't start in that place. Which is, this is great news. So not only do I have the data that says here's what we did, but I can tell you a number of anecdotal stories about some things that have gone on. Let me stress with you the importance of the alignment issue, because me throwing my little pebble in the pond would not do anything unless we were working cooperatively with the K-12 side of the shop also. A story about the importance, if I can, about the alignment issue. As we sat down and talked with the K-12 staff about some of the work and the curriculum alignment that needed to occur, we discovered that our exit standard for our pre-K program in math was higher than the exit standard for the kindergarten. Well, does that cause a discussion in your local school district? And so you start to, when I talk about the importance of the re-engineering and looking at it from a systemic viewpoint and looking across the spectrum of these grade levels, to make a difference in achievement, you have to do that. Let me tell you, I think Senator Hoffman referred to a point that I've emphasized a few times, and I talked about it in Senator Torres Ray's committee. The importance from a public policy standpoint of establishing a bullseye, if you will, and I'll use that analogy. For us to do this, we had to describe and define in our school district what it meant to be kindergarten ready in Anoka-Hennepin. You have to have a place in which to reference yourself. The importance of the reference point for you as policymakers to say, how do you hold us accountable as systems or for programs and investments we are making in early learning without a reference point? And otherwise, we can just all kind of shift the chairs on the deck and nothing really moves. So for us, in our school district, to move forward, we had to create that definition. I would suggest public policy would be wise for us to have a state standard of what it means to be kindergarten ready. In our district, we've established one. So we have a way to reference whether our staff development, our instructional, our curriculum efforts are actually achieving the results that we're trying to get at. So those are some of the pieces, and there are a number of things that we can talk about that have assisted us in being successful. But in the interest of time, I'll wait and see if you have questions. I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Superintendent Dave Webb from South St. Paul, who can talk about some of the experiences they've had in South St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr, and welcome, Superintendent Webb.
Thank you. I'll start with Dave Webb, just to state my name. So just a brief story. First of all, maybe I'll start with a thank you. Thank you for all of your work in the last legislative session to put school districts in the position we're in this year. And I think we're in a really similar spot with your work in this current session as we are as superintendents in school districts around the state. We have a few additional dollars this year that have come our way, and we have to make our best decisions about how and where to invest those scarce resources. So as we, with our school district, look at allocating those limited dollars toward the highest return on investment, early learning has come to our forefront. If you look at what's happening within South St. Paul, we're in the middle of a construction phase to add early learning classrooms onto our two elementary schools in our district. We're nowhere near the scope and size of Anoka-Hennepin. We're at the other end of the spectrum for size, but we have the exact same targets. And they're the exact same targets that came out of the legislation from the House and Senate last year for World's Best Workforce. It's to get more and more of our kids college and career ready, to close the achievement gap for all of our kids in the state. And by doing that, if you look at the leaders in the country, as we do as superintendents, we always want to have the better edge than all the other districts around us. You begin looking nationally for who's making a difference. So in Montgomery County, Maryland, there's a school district that in the Newsweek's top 100, they have all seven of their high schools in the top 100 Newsweek rankings. If you listen to what Jerry Wiest has to say as superintendent, it all is about starting early. And if you can start early and get kids off to a great start right from the beginning, you don't have to spend all the remediation dollars all the way up through the system. That's where we're turning our sights in South St. Paul. And so we were already providing all-day K. We're in a very forward-thinking school district with a forward-thinking community that wants to do the best for our kids. We've done all-day K for the past 7 or 8 years. We're taking some of those limited dollars now and redirecting those to four-year-old program dollars to fund, for the first time ever next fall, five-day-a-week, half-day programs for kids in South St. Paul. The challenge is that we, with those limited dollars, we can only fund about 30 students, 30 additional kids for our programs. I'll also say that we're the only organization that can reduce the barriers to help our high poverty families get access to those scholarships. We can provide the free bus to get them in the door, a free breakfast, as all of them would qualify for the free breakfast coming to start the day, the free half-day program, a free lunch, and possibly qualify for afternoon childcare before they take a free bus ride home. And in that way, we've reduced all of those barriers. So we're investing early, and it goes counterintuitive. Most people think when you want great college and career readiness results, mm-hmm. you need to invest in your high schools. So we're turning our sights differently, following national models. And I would also say, going back to the Anoka points about changing the benchmarks, there are real clear college and career benchmarks for every grade. And so our parent conferences in first kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade show those benchmarks for the first time this fall to parents about what is college and career ready. So when they graduate, if their target is a 24 ACT to get into colleges around our state and around the nation, you have to start early to make sure kids are on track. So thank you for all the great work you're doing. Thank you for being forward-thinking for Minnesota schools. And thank you for the invitation to be here today.
Thank you, Superintendent Webb. Senator Johnson, followed by Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair and friends, I can't say enough about what I've heard you say, Superintendent Webb. I think what you're doing is doing what I think we all need to start looking at is the non-academic barriers to learning. And it is when we have, you know, almost 40% of our students in Minnesota are under the free and reduced rating. We know that they have challenges at home, and certainly it would be best if parents could take proper care of their children or give them what they need in order to learn, but sometimes they're not able to or they're not willing to. And so the schools step in because that's where the schools are. And how can you possibly expect a student to learn? And so you're wasting your teacher's time if you have children in there that are in class that are hungry or other challenges that you have addressed. And I really appreciate the work that Anoka Hennepin has done. When I went to the breakfast at Adams School in elementary school in Coon Rapids, the principal, it wasn't a kind of an event, a PR event, and the principal was dressed in overalls with suspenders on and walking around with a straw hat like he was a farmer. And then when he said, you know, he asked the kids who were having the breakfast, say, why do you have to have a good breakfast to go to? And they all shouted out, college. So that's the example of that. What you're saying is this is the time to start preparing our kids for college. And I appreciate your efforts, and I hope that we can pass the free breakfast bill this year. For everyone. Free breakfast for everyone. Yeah, eligible.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for in allowing me to speak that way.
Of course. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Johnson, I'm now a convert on that free breakfast for all. So. You know, I think the testimony here today with this is just exactly what we had hoped would happen when we passed what we passed last year, because we did a few things. We said that we're going to do all day K, but if you already were doing that and didn't need the resources, we passed a law that said you could use those for, I believe it was 3- and 4-year-old programming.
Right.
So that's just outstanding that you're able to take advantage of that.
Sponsored by Senator Kent, too.
And, yeah, I know. Thank you, Senator Kent. In addition, to be able to do the scholarship piece and give parents choice about you know, picking high-quality places and then put resources into the early readiness so that you are high-quality and you're going to be the places that those parents pick, because why wouldn't they? But it's also so important that they actually do have that choice, and so that is part of the parent engagement part, is giving them those tools. So I would just thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Hoffman, and I'm a strong supporter of this as well as what we're doing with the scholarships.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, you know, we always look at what drives a good policy and return on investment and data. And every time I come in front of you in this committee and you look at the data that's driving the results, moving benchmarks, high rigor, we're talking about 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids and we're doing this. So if this should be enough marketing to keep us moving forward on the sense of what Senator Bonoff is saying. So thank you very much.
Senator Bonoff.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman. I am also a broken record around a program that has 40 years of data around it, and that's a program called the Parent-Child Home Program that we have also put money towards and which I'll continue to talk about. But that, too, is a early literacy, early intervention, home visiting program that shows those kids when they do that between 18 months and 4 years old, they graduate at the same rate as their middle class peers. So I am a believer in data, and I'll stand with you on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience I'd like to testify? Not Senator Sexton.
Well, I was just going to make one comment. I think that what you're telling us is terrific. It's unbelievable, but it's believable to me. But we do we are using different models throughout the state of Minnesota: rural, high poverty, low poverty, the largest school district, and I think that I think we're finding out that different strokes from different folks are working, and I'm really upbeat on what's happening here. So.
Maybe just Senator Saxock, just a quick comment, Chair Wieger, if that's okay. I think we've kind of represented school readiness as a program, but in some cases it's also used as a funding stream. The statute I actually feel fairly strongly about is a very strong and well-written statute that gives school districts across the state a lot of flexibility in how they apply the resources locally. And some of my information may be a little bit dated, but I believe in Rochester, for example, they use the funding they get from this as another form of scholarship for placement in high-quality settings in the community. And I know I'm a country boy from outstate Minnesota, and frankly, you know, I know in some of the small communities out there how they're utilizing it is in a scholarship fashion or for placement, or they're pairing up with Head Start to place these children because they don't have enough resources. Frankly, we haven't done any funding increase. They don't have enough resources really to do standalone programs in some parts of Minnesota. So it is a strong statute. It is a good base to build off of, but it does allow that flexibility that you referred to across the state in its application.
Good. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, if you'd like to move Senate File 1721 as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1721 as amended be laid over for inclusion into, I believe, our omnibus. Is that correct?
Further discussion? If not, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Carried. Thank you, Senator Hoffman, and to your witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
2520, Senator Hoffman is before us.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you today for hearing Senate file, actually this morning, for hearing Senate file 2520 legislation. I believe, Mr. Chair and members, that this is going to provide a middle-class tax cut for working Minnesotans through school equalization formulas. With me at the table is former State Senator Grace, now Grace Kelleher, who is with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Ms. Kelleher will discuss the bill and walk through select recommendations from the school capital facilities working group, which I might add also, Mr. Chair, that she was a member of this working group. Also in the crowd today is Tom Melcher, in case anybody wants to get deep in the weeds on funding formulas. There's a guy that forgets more in a day than any of us will ever know regarding formulas in this state. So thank you, Mr. Melcher, for making yourself available as if those questions were to come up. But here, what Senate File 2520 attempts to significantly improve the state equalization of facilities levies and stabilize the state share of revenue by indexing equalizing factors to the state average ANTC. Generally, in education, it is the responsibility of school boards to build and maintain school facilities. As you know, boards are elected to maximize and maintain educational facilities for our students now and in the future. It is our responsibility as legislators to provide school boards access to the resources to construct and maintain those facilities and provide a uniform, safe, and healthy environment for every student, i.e. Article 13 of our state's constitution, which we started a year ago getting educated on. History. I want to just give you a little brief history of this. When I first received this bill, there were some shoes that needed to be filled in this, and so I did my homework and found that there was a young senator a few years ago that had spearheaded and audited every single school facility statewide and analyzed their maintenance for their need. It was about a $3 billion report. Yeah. The result of this report startled the Capitol and changed education policy as we know it today. And it's nice to let's recognize Senator Wigger on what you did a few years ago on that was your
it's
report.
More than setting. A few, but yeah.
So that just shows our dedication and the history of dedication to students in the state. So the rationale behind Senate File 2520 is that the state share of debt service revenue has declined from 11.3% in fiscal year 1995 to 3.1% now in fiscal year 2015. Currently, 80% of all debt service revenue is below the threshold to qualify for equalization. And that equalizing factor for Tier 1 equalization is so low that only 7% of the state students are in districts where the tax base per student is low enough to qualify for that Tier 1 equalization aid. A stronger state commitment to debt service equalization is needed to ensure that all of our districts have access to adequate, equitable, and sustainable funding for the major facilities projects, regardless of local tax base. And right now, current facilities revenue total about $1.3 billion, or $1,428 on the per pupil unit on average of almost half, $627 million, comes from categorical formulas that allow districts or charters to levy or receive aid without voter approval. The members, as a former school board member, I understand the importance of state keeping and funding their commitments to assist local school districts construct and maintain their school facilities. A good quality school building should be on the right of every child in the state, no matter where they live or what zip code they're from. Ms. Kelleher will now have some remarks regarding the bill.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman and Ms. Kelleher. And for the members, you were a member of this committee that may not be aware of that. Where was your chair again?
Where did you sit? Mr. Chairman and members, I believe I sat just where Senator Weber is sitting. So that was sort of the chair.
She would have sat next to me.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It is wonderful to be here today. And I want to thank Senator Hoffman. In many ways, he has spearheaded this whole reflection on equalization. We saw part of it enacted last year, and I hope you've heard from school districts that it was a real game changer. The problem is this all started with the Skeen decision, and it was at a point where the legislature wasn't noticing differences in tax base around the state. So if you think about LGA, and you maybe serve on one of those committees, this is the school equivalent, which is equalization. Unfortunately, they enacted it, and the Skeen decision came back, and it sort of lingered And there's really been no updating of these formulas in so long. They're out of whack, and we really need help. And I think the Facilities Committee, which comprised 15 members from all around the state, came to a joint recommendation that equalization had to be a pillar of capital facilities programs and endeavors. The reason you don't see the department up here with this bill, with all the recommendations from the working group, is that it came in so late that it didn't make the agency process. So we wanted to make sure that if the governor is, in fact, interested in doing middle-class tax relief, he, in fact, has a vehicle to fund school levies and provide that tax relief. So with that, members, I want to just share some specific recommendations from the committee. They recommended, when dealing with equalization, that all school levies, including debt service revenue, long-term maintenance revenue, facilities improvement revenue, operating capital revenue, and capital projects referendum should all be equalized by the state. And I'll have a graph that I show you, but the first thing we noticed is we laid out all the capital funding formulas. Some were highly equalized, some were moderately, and then there were some that got none. So as that piecemeal facilities had been enacted throughout the years, they hadn't been done with sort of the same set of eyes going forward. So this would change that. We wanted to bring equity to students and equity to taxpayers, and we, in fact, created a way to do it. Let me tie you to the handouts I gave you. If you want to just turn there, I'm a pictures person. I sometimes think a picture says 100 words. And I just give you, I talked about the different levels of equalization in capital facilities. This actually gives you the percentages around the state. So 65% of school facility revenues are not equalized at all. The highly equalized, or where this program initially started, is 13.7%. So you really see at the local level what schools are dealing with to maintain their buildings and build new buildings. So this impacts all those decisions. If you turn to the next page, catch up to you, you'll find that I actually did it by a related revenue by program going forward. And the four that this bill talks about is the voter-approved debt, which is 45% of the facilities revenue, health and safety, and deferred maintenance, and alt facilities, and bringing an equalized formula to all those. My favorite graph is the next one, which actually shows what happened in debt service. And as a former school board member, and I know Senator Hoffman understands, when we passed a referendum, we went out and shared with the public why we thought that was a good idea. And part of that included numbers that showed the state supporting these referendums over 20 years. Well, I had a rude awakening after we'd passed one in Albert Lea and then found that the equalization kept drifting downward, so the community had to pay more, and it was just a sad thing. So the promises we'd asked the public to invest in us really didn't hold up because the state didn't hold up their end of the deal. I provide you some information from Ehlers, sort of an average, and you get to see what the state average is and where first-tier and second-tier debt service is, and you can see by the very bottom, virtually nobody gets that first-tier debt service support. Here is, moving on to the next one, debt equalization aid as part of the eligible debt revenue. Once again, a program that just has gone off the mark. So with that, members, the bill itself covers debt service equalization, health and safety equalization, alternate facilities equalization, and deferred maintenance equalization. And as Senator Hoffman said, we believe this bill, and it is expensive, members, I'm not going to hide it from you. This is a great way, though, to give every school an equal foot around the state and provide taxpayer relief statewide. So with that, Fain, I will pause and answer questions if there are any.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher, and I know that Dr. Melcher is here if you wanted to comment on the proposal. It's an investment. You can also refer to it as taxpayer relief. But the need is very compelling. We understand that. I believe it's $70 million or so in the out year. Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the school finance director at the Department of Education, and I provided staff support to the facilities working group. One of the things that the facilities working group noted is, as has been discussed, that we've had an erosion of state support for facilities over the years, and the facilities working group did recommend that we restore our level of equalization for facilities funding programs, and that we make some changes so that those state shares would stay more uniform, more constant over the years. And what's in this bill is consistent with those pieces of the facilities working group that dealt with equalization.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr.
Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity in Education, and I would be totally remiss in my duties if I did not get up and strongly support this bill that Senator Hoffman has authored. Ms. Kelleher summed it up very well. I think that there's working on this issue as long as I have, when the debt service equalization was established, I think for Pay 93, many districts went out and they would said to their voters, the state is going to pick up 25, 30, 40% of whatever the debt service load will be. And 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, that would become, you know, steadily go down until it was all local revenue funding the debt service. Part of education funding, I think, and where equalization fits in is there's a union between resources and tax burden. And tax policy and education policy come together on this subject of equalization. One of the goals, of course, is to have equitable distribution of overall resources, but sometimes what gets lost in that is the equitable distribution of the tax burden. And we see disparate tax burdens that are, you know, throughout the state to fund buildings and operations. Last year, the Senate, under Senator Scoy, was very strong in increasing the equalization on the operations side. This is the other side of the coin when we come to the facilities issues. Facilities are important, regardless of how much blended learning and how much we're going to give a kid an iPad and he's going to learn everything. There's still going to be a building, and buildings are going to be central to the operations of school districts, and I think that Senator Hoffman recognizes that in his bill, and we're very much in support of this and look forward to working with him and the committee as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Ms. Ciccone, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Mary Ciccone, Parents United. I just want to observe that you have lots of individual districts come forward and say, please help us, please help us. And you're in a very difficult position. This particular bill, we highly support. It's a reform to a formula that's sorely needed. And it corrects a misstep from your predecessors. The intent in 1993 was appropriate. However, they need to go the next step, and that's where you are right now. I know it's expensive, but it is tax relief. It is essential, and it is something that the state sorely needs. It's your opportunity to reform a formula. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scone. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 2520?
Mr. Chair, Committee, I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, representing 175 school districts, 160,000 students. This is consistent with our platform to bring equalization and greater revenue for facilities. This is the equalization part, and we also would support this.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Anyone further? Well, Senator Hoffman, clearly the need has been established. The task force has laid it out just as was asked for. Senator Stump served on that task force. Senator Dahl had a number of other recommendations at an earlier hearing. And I think the realistic part is we know at best there might be a down payment on addressing the need, but the need does not go away. So thank you for reminding us of the importance of it to you and your witnesses. And we'll entertain a motion to lay Senate File 2520 over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that. I make that motion, so thank you.
On Senator Hoffman's motion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator Hoffman, and to your witnesses.
Mr. Thank Chair you, and members, thank you.
We now have Senate File 2207, Senator Kent, K-12 Physical Education. Perhaps there's an E-12 Physical Education as well.
It's like the same one.
Yeah. There we go.
Any amendments to this?
I know.
This has been service aid.
Welcome, Senator Kent. And I believe this was heard in policy as well for those of us that did have a great presentation earlier. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yes, we did go through this in policy, so we'll keep it a little more streamlined today. I'm here this morning to introduce Senate File 2207, a bill that would instruct the department to report on K-12 students' experience with physical activity and physical education. There's been a lot of attention recently on several key issues of student wellness, reflecting both the critical effects on the long-term health of our children as well as the ability their ability to learn effectively. We are rightly talking about childhood obesity, as well as the need for students to have healthy breakfasts and lunches to ensure they're ready to learn, in addition to having a healthy foundation for their lifelong wellness. Another important aspect of both long-term health and effective learning is physical activity and physical education. It goes without saying that good habits and physical activity are key to healthy living. There's also significant research that demonstrates that movement and physical activity during the school day has positive effects on learning. Because of this significance, the legislature in 2010 adopted PE standards from the National Association for Sport and Physical Education, also known as NASPE. This was a very important step forward for Minnesota's kids, but we all know the need to monitor and ensure effective implementation and to adjust programs to reflect ongoing research and best practices. Therefore, this bill is designed to move forward with this kind of monitoring by assessing the implementation and impact of the 2010 policy and evaluating the current state of physical education in Minnesota schools. The bill asks the department to survey school districts and provide a report on the amount of time spent in PE, the nature of PE classes, schools' use of data in assessing student fitness, as well as details about students' access to recess. There is a fiscal implication to this bill. We're still waiting for a fiscal note. We've requested it, but as of this morning, we haven't seen one yet. The ranges on this are pretty low. I've heard anywhere from like $20,000 to maybe $50,000. And one thing that's important to consider is that this is supported by a coalition for healthy kids in Minnesota. So it's the Heart Association, the Cancer Society, and they and their staff stand ready to help implement this. And they've been in conversations with the department on this issue. So, hopefully, ultimately, the cost to the department would be quite negligible.
Senator Kent, when do you expect to have that fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we should have it any moment. It's fairly soon. I wouldn't be surprised if it's today.
Okay. It was requested a while ago, so I know it's a busy time.
Thank you.
In the meantime, here with me today to provide a few more details and answer questions is Jack Olwell of the Minnesota Association of Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance, and he's also a PE teacher in the Farmington School District.
Welcome.
Thank you,
Mr. Olwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Once again, my name is Jack Olwell. I am a 37-year elementary physical educator, most of that time spent in Farmington at North Trail Elementary. I'm also on the board of directors for Minnesota AFERD, soon to be known as SHAPE Minnesota, after our national parent organization. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about this most important step that passage of Senate File 2207 will provide towards the improvement, not just of physical education, but of academic achievement of all students across Minnesota. A strong physical education program produces a multitude of benefits for students and can transform the schools that implement them. Quality programs have the proven ability to increase attendance, reduce disciplinary incidents, and dramatically improve the two health components that influence learning the most, weight and cardiovascular fitness. A few years back, our school district made cuts to physical education to make more room for academics. Our school board met our protests with a daunting but legitimate challenge: demonstrate to us the relevance of physical education. And that is why I'm here today as well. It is now 8 years later, and we have compiled some remarkable results. Our response was to launch a PE class for struggling readers. Fifth grade students who scored below the national average on the NWEA standardized test were enrolled over the winter quarter in a 15-minute class at the start of each school day, in which literacy components were embedded into active games. Our participants showed gains 4 to 5 times the national average and 2 to 3 times that of their peers. This class and these results have been consistently replicated both at the elementary and middle school levels in a number of school districts in this state and others as well. These outcomes are supported by brain research that shows that exercise turns on the brain. Blood volume to the hippocampus, the center for memory and learning, more than doubles following exercise. This is significant because the brain stores no fuel of its own. It is entirely dependent upon the cardiovascular system to supply its considerable needs. It should come as no surprise, then, that Dr. Charles Hillman at the University of Illinois found that following moderate physical activity, students test a full grade level higher in reading. Academic performance and learning peak immediately following physical activity, and perhaps this is why before the MCAs, the North Trail Elementary playground is filled with students running, so that they would be ready to test well. So if fitness in general and cardiovascular fitness in particular are so crucial to learning, then how does physical education impact this? To find this out, we tested locally and looked nationally for evidence. This fall and again in the winter, we tested all North Trail third graders, that's 120 third graders, and at the North Trail in the NWA reading and the Presidential Ruth Youth Fitness Aerobic Test. Students that were at or above the national average had a 20% higher PACER score, which is their aerobic score. Students who were at or above the national average, the post-test scores for the Lit PE kids improved nearly 5 times as much on their PACER test as their non-participating peers. Their reading gains were more than double. This was also replicated at Cedar Park Elementary and Apple Valley, who had even better results. So as fitness scores increase, so do test scores. This mirrors large population studies in California and Texas involving millions of students who showed a significant correlation between fitness and test scores, attendance, and lower disciplinary issues. We already know that daily PE fights one of the worst enemies of learning, obesity. A Robert Wood Foundation study found that for each day of the week that PE a student receives, there was a 5% lower incidence of obesity, up to 28% if the student received PE daily. But how can we measure the impact of a dramatic increase of physical activity or physical education during the school day? We have seen the effect of adding 15 extra minutes to students who already receive 25 minutes daily. But perhaps the most dramatic impact can be seen at Anthony Elementary in Leavenworth, Kansas. Anthony was 10th and last in reading and 9th in math. The following year, they went from once weekly to daily physical activity and physical education. In 1 year, they went from last in math to last in reading to second and first in math. They also had a 1,300% increase in students passing the physical fitness test, and that's not all. Their disciplinary issues dropped from 438 to 18 in a single year. Perhaps Dr. John Medina, a developmental molecular biologist, summed up the effectiveness of this current trend in education to reduce PE best when he said, "Cutting off physical exercise, the very activity most likely to promote cognitive performance, to do better on a test score is like trying to gain weight by starving yourself." Titusville, Pennsylvania, proved Dr. Medina's point when they lengthened their school day and reduced their academic time to make room for daily PE. In 1 year, they went from below the state average in both reading and math to 17 and 18% above the state average. At the present time, we do not have a handle on what is provided for PE across the state. All Minnesota children deserve to have the same opportunities to success, and PE is proven to be an important factor in that. Currently, MDE does not track the quality or quantity of PE in Minnesota schools. This bill would provide the information necessary to get a snapshot of how the 2010 standard law is working and to better understand how we can improve PE across the Minnesota schools. I would like to encourage you to support the passage of Senate File 2207 so we can begin to build a healthier and smarter Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orwell. Senator Jensen, followed by Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, I just have a couple questions. Within this report framework, I'm wondering if we can include, and I'd like to work on you with this until the report comes. I'm made aware of some issues when it comes to physical education for students that have other issues that impact their physical activity. And when we set up programs that say they need an assessment or they want to see, I'm concerned that we don't take that into account enough, and we need to do that more. I have a son that we didn't know had a developmental type delay, a coordination delay, and was forced to run the presidential mile 3 times because they felt he didn't do it up to his potential.
Yeah.
We're struggling with that. He has anxiety to go to Phi Ed. He stresses that this he's not as good as the other kids in the school. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that if he works out on the treadmill, he'll get better. Mm-hmm. This is a physical delay. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that we can incorporate some of those thoughts and some of those things into a report like this. And I'm not sure what that looks like or how we do that, but I'm really concerned about that and hope that we can try to incorporate that. I don't know if you have comments on that, but I'd be willing and want to work with you on that.
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, thank you. You raised an important consideration, and I would definitely be open, and I'm quite sure that the coalition would as well. Just for context, as we talked about the fiscal considerations of this, as always, when we look at doing a survey of any kind, it's a balancing act between trying to make it something that the department can manage and something that school districts will respond to.
Sure.
But within that balancing act, I think this is something that you raise a very important consideration.
Yes, Senator Jensen and Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, you describe a situation that both at SHAPE Minnesota and professional educators are trying to get away from. This is your only experience, and instead of being a positive in his life, it's a negative, and that mm-hmm. is the very thing that we are working against.
Okay.
And we do not want to use a person's fitness or physical condition as a negative. We're trying to use it to enhance their education.
Okay.
And so hopefully what you have experienced with your son is just a small part that we're hoping to eliminate as time goes on.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Senator Dahl, Bonoff, and Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Orwell, I am supportive of the bill and co-author. And as a teacher for 30 years, I also can I know students sometimes are afraid of PE. Do you have any anecdotal evidence? You say you don't have data statewide, but what are your big concerns? I'm sure you in your organization have talked about maybe trends that some schools are moving towards. And, you know, many years ago I was horrified that we're doing PE online, but actually it seems to be working a little in our school. And they even offer it in the summer. But other thing I think you might throw into this whole thing is recess. My wife is so irate that my fifth-grade daughter has to take choir during recess a couple days a week. But just kind of anecdotally maybe, what kind of trends do you see statewide that has drawn some of your biggest concerns?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, one of the things that we're fighting is the very thing that you're discussing, and that is I feel that we are up against many obstacles, one of which is the general perception of who we are. as physical educators. I don't think you have to look too far in the media to see how we're portrayed, and that's something that we have to fight against. But you bring up a very important part about recess. You know, recess has been shown through research that it is not just important in terms of activity levels, but it's also very important for brain development. When that is withdrawn, they've done animal studies that they prevent animals from playing, and they find out that they're more aggressive, they find out that their brains are less developed, and they have fewer social skills. So recess has very, very many implications for the growth and development of a child.
But, excuse me on this, but Senator Ellen Anderson, former
that's
senator.
That's what I was thinking of,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, no, she had some very good testimony with on that subject, so some of us that have been around a while are relating to what you're sharing right now.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to say that, yes, I think every organization has, I'm going to say, bad apples. And I do think that we have to, essentially, we have to push them through. And hopefully that will happen new, that the new physical education that is coming in is not the same as the old one. And unfortunately, many of us experienced, myself included, the old physical education, which could be demeaning and focused on all the wrong things. But we are focusing on the future health and the future abilities of our students, and not on what they can't do, but on what they can do.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, as I look around this table, I see a number of us have kids around the same age and are sort of in this kind of around middle school years and kind of living this on a day-to-day basis. That was part of what motivated me to carry this bill. Because in one of my school districts, they had a grant a few years ago that brought in sort of innovations, exactly as Mr. Olwell is describing, in terms of some of these new approaches to physical education that are much more effective and research-based, and recognizing that activity spaced throughout the day helps kids learn. It just helps them in so many different ways. And at about the same time, I think my son was in second grade, and he had PE in his last hour of school. Which was great. You know, somebody has to have PE the last hour of school. But that meant he'd spent his entire day sitting at a desk largely with a little bit of recess. And so it is reflecting on that and exactly what you're talking about that is why I believe this is important. We need to understand what is happening. And I'll draw your attention to lines 1.16. Nope, sorry, the one above. No, where am I? There it is, 1.18 and 1.19. We specifically added in a survey question about recess for that very reason, because it's not just PE. It's mm-hmm. physical activity overall. And the point is, I think it's Senator Peterson who likes to say, if you don't measure it, you don't do it, you don't know it. If we don't measure this, we don't know where we stand, and we're not in a position to evaluate how we need to move forward as a state and for our districts and to support our districts to implement the programs that will help our kids.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can tell we're all very passionate about this subject around this table. I carried the initiative that put the PE standards in 2010, and I want to thank Ms. Callahan, who's in the sitting over there, for the work of the American Heart Association and her hard work. I was motivated to do that because I have four kids. One of mine, a boy, is just, you know, filled with bursts of energy. I mean, you could say many things. You could label it many things, but I prefer to call it lots of energy. But I remember a little mischief, maybe a lot of mischief, too. But I remember there was a point in fifth grade where his teacher called me and requested that I consider medication. I was like, are you kidding? You know, that wasn't the direction that as a family we were going to go. And so the direction we went is he had to be in a sport every single trimester. The more physical activity he did, the better he was able to calm those bursts of energy. And he ended up, you know, graduating with honors and doing, you know, very well in college. And I worried about that he wasn't in a sport in college, and I saw the difference, but learned how to moderate a little bit. But in fact, that legislation that we passed then did actually have a clause in there that said school districts were supposed to get a healthy school award if they did more than a certain amount. And I don't know if that ever was implemented. I think we didn't give it any money. And so, no, I can see. It never really was. But that was the point to that part of the bill was to try and give school districts incentive. And it included recess in its measure. So I would just ask you also, Senator Kent, to go back and look for that and see, you know, I think this understanding where we're at is the perfect first step. But just look at the tenets of that provision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Kent, thanks for bringing this forward. I want to echo what Senator Jensen is bringing forward and would like you to look at, because I'm looking at this and wondering, what about including the collaboration with your developmentally adaptive physical education professionals that are purposeful, planning, meaningful? Anecdotally, in elementary schools, it works, and then all of a sudden, middle and high school, there really is no real discussion about reasonable accommodations under 504. I don't see anything in here that would suggest that they work in collaboration. So I'd really like to echo where Senator Jensen's going and would offer that as a request as well. You've left out in here, you got which activities qualify. Well, qualify for what? Qualify to substitute. Well, you know, under federal law, that if it's unique and individual to the kiddo himself, the IEP team will make those recommendations. And so I would like to see some more avenues of collaboration in here and to see this go forward, because I too, like Senator Jensen had a kid who had the same concern. So you got two senators sitting on this small group, and if we call that anecdotal, I'd say you're pretty close to getting some kind of consensus here on something. So can you please work with her on that language, and I'd be more than happy to offer my help as well. So.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, I do commit to Senator Jensen and to you to do that.
Thank you. That's not for the record. There'll be that additional language to make sure the forthcoming study will be sensitized to that important need. One item that I shared at an earlier meeting at a classroom visit, I believe it was in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, one of the elementary teachers would routinely have a breaks maybe at 40-minute intervals or so where the students say, just get up. And like a timeout, they would exercise maybe for 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and then back to their reading. And they had documented that was much better. It was like a re-energizing experience for them. And not asking for you to look into that further. You've already shown a lot of improvement there, but I just wanted to note that for the record, where the principal and the others, they were saying this is a very good technique, tying that in. So I was very impressed. And actually, they had myself and others exercising with the kids, and I remember that very well.
Well, Chairman Wieger, maybe I can just offer one more anecdotal. North Trail, where I teach, we have physical education every day. I see the kids, 600 kids. We're the only school in the district. And we had a couple teachers that transferred in, and they only had it twice a week at their buildings. And they're under a lot of pressure to make academic progress. And so they were very hesitant to bring their kids voluntarily for an extra session. And after a few weeks, they approached me and said, we'd never go back. We want to make sure our kids are active throughout the day. The one thing that I'd like to address about the activity breaks, or the brain breaks is I think what they're called, is they are effective tools academically, but we have yet to see any research that shows that they are a good health tool or a good skill-building tool, whereas physical education has plenty of evidence to support that.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, I apologize for getting here late, but I did want to ask, what would you say are the barriers that schools have that keep them from having more physical education?
Mr. Alba.
Chairman Wieger and Senator Hall, I think the barriers, there is two primary barriers. The first one is funding. Funding is a, obviously it's an obstacle for anything, and in fact, I hope don't take any offense to this, but I look at education like I look at my wife's closet, and that is there's a lot of really cool stuff in there. not my closet, not so much cool stuff, but in her closet, there's really cool stuff, but there's no room for anything new unless you take something out. And the same thing is true when you add something in education, something else consequently suffers, and I think there's some resistance to that. But as we've seen with the Titusville schools, if you reduce proportionately each of the academic subjects and add physical education for on a daily basis, your academics improve markedly. The second thing I would say is that we are, as I mentioned earlier, I think we are fighting the notion that physical education is not an academic tool. And that has been proven time and again not to be so. In fact, it's an essential academic tool.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you then say that it's more of, instead of maybe funding, it's more of priorities that we're doing? And I just want to thank you for something like this. As a former FIAD major, health FIAD major and teacher, this to me seems to be one of the elements that we're missing in the schools. And I didn't hear the stats, but someone once told me that about 50% of the schools now are not doing FIAD. And I don't know I don't remember if you spoke, because again I got here a little late. But thank you, because this is very important.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Hall, that's exactly the purpose of this bill. We don't know, and this is to ask the question and to ask the department to do a survey around the state and figure out where we stand, so we can figure out how to move forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I think this discussion really calls attention to how much we expect or want from our schools, and the more we learn, the more we see avenues that we think will be very helpful to children. And I think this committee is the number one committee in the legislature that hears about all these stories. But, you know, it's difficult to understand how the schools can meet the expectations that many of us have without really taking them under our wing and saying, we are going to help you as much as possible to do this, because it's not really your job. These are considered to be non-academic barriers to learning. But they're like eyeglasses or obesity or bullying or physical education, physical activity. Those are, you know, we placed a lot of emphasis on classroom study, reading and math scores. And if they aren't where we think they should be, then we start penalizing the schools in certain ways. And it's really more about us than the schools. The legislature sets the priorities for schools, and you know, the people that administer try as hard as they can, I believe, to try to meet those expectations. But sometimes we just don't give them the tools they need to reach our expectations. But I appreciate your work. So,
thank you. Senator Kent will entertain a motion, and with the understanding you'll be working addressing some of the concerns noted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move that Senate File 2207 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
On that motion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you very much, Senator Kent, Mr. Allwell. And members, here's where we're at. I believe targets will be announced soon, and we will meet next week. On Tuesday, it's my intent, as in the past, to meet with each caucus with a draft omnibus bill. On Wednesday, the 26th, that will be published. And on Thursday, the 27th, we would review it, take testimony, and act. And the following week, it would be processed to the full Finance Committee, which ultimately, it's my understanding, as we have done in the even year, it would be conferenced as one large bill with other appropriation matters. Questions? Where we're at? Well, very good. There being no further business, our committee is adjourned.